You may have noticed the blue posters with the words, "Hate has no home here," popping up all over the place.
It's really important for people to hear that a lot of people believe in goodness and kindness and respect and in civil discourse. And that's what this project does. It gives everybody a chance to feel like they're not alone when they are rejecting hate.
We talk with the Chicago-based creators of the campaign, which is spread not just across the state, but the world. But first, why is it so important to address gun violence as a public health issue?
I think on all sides, people are traumatized. People are angry and they're traumatized and they want their identities to be respected. We have to find more ways to respect and honor each other and to be hopeful that we can make this problem better.
University of Chicago criminologist Harold Pollack joins us to talk about solutions to the issue of gun violence all across Illinois. That's coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. All summer, we've been talking about gun violence across Illinois. We've learned about efforts that were being made in Peoria, Springfield, Champaign, and Rockford to stop the violence. Today, we go to Chicago. Last year, 815 people died from homicides in Chicago. The city's unfortunately already on track to see the same level of carnage this year as it saw last year. That's according to data from the Cook County Medical Examiner's Office compiled by WBEZ. Between this past Friday and Monday morning, 9 people were killed and 54 others wounded in shootings across Chicago. Joining us now is Harold Pollack. He's co-director of the University of Chicago's Crime Lab. He also teaches in the School of Social Service Administration at the University of Chicago. Harold, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Thanks so much for having me.
Before we get into all of the communities, because obviously Chicago gets a lot of headlines for its violence, I did want to ask you about numbers of gun violence, specifically in Chicago, because when you look at the numbers over a historical time period, we see a spike in the 90s. In recent years, a steady decline until 2016. Can you give us a sense of numbers and what's happening from a historical perspective?
Yeah, we're a lot safer than we were 25 years ago in Chicago. But we have lost a lot of ground in the past couple of years. And so we're back to the level of maybe 15 years ago. And so it's a significant issue. I should say there's really nothing going on in Chicago that's not going on in many other cities. We are not Dodge City in Chicago. You know, St. Louis, Baltimore, Cleveland, Detroit, many cities are experiencing similar challenges to Chicago, but we are a lot more dangerous than New York or Los Angeles. And so we do face some significant challenges.
What kind of work do you do for people who aren't familiar at the Crime Lab? What are things at the University of Chicago, and what kind of work are you looking at? How do you look at this issue?
So I should say I'm just one of many people that work at the University of Chicago Urban Labs. At the Crime Lab, which is headed by Jens Ludwig, we do really two types of things. One thing that we do is we do randomized trials of violence prevention interventions. The Becoming a Man intervention evaluation was one of the most well-known things that we've done, but we've done many other things. We've done randomized trials of summer job programs to see whether those can reduce violent offending among youth. We also do a lot of technical assistance and a lot of research in partnership with the city, county, and state agencies. One of our core aspirations is to give people a sense of evidence-based, realistic optimism that something can be done. These problems are so challenging, and from both right and left, you can really get a sense of despair and thinking the only way we can really address these problems is by getting a handle on these really deeply rooted things. You know, on the right, people will say, well, all we have to do is get rid of all the negative messages in pop culture and single parenthood and all the, and things like that. And then on the left, people say, all we have to do is get rid of poverty and segregation, and then we can handle our violence problem. And boy, those are really, really long-term challenges.
Those are very big issues, right?
Yes.
So I wonder, from a research perspective, how do you look at this? Because I think a lot of people see numbers, whether it's Chicago, and a lot of this, and I'm also curious sort of how you handle, I'm going to start with just how do you handle just sort of looking at the numbers, whether you hear Chicago, I appreciate how you put it in perspective for other cities, right? Because when we think about proportionately Certainly the number is high and horrific, but you're putting it in place, right, with the data. How do you think we should look at violence, whether it happens in Chicago or Champaign or Springfield? From your research perspective, how do you do that?
Well, one thing I would say is it's one of the most fundamental challenges that Chicago faces as a city and many other cities face. It's very, very hard to get a handle on any other urban problem when violence is escalating. It's you want to do economic development, and you talk to people who are, say, building 7-Elevens, and they'll say, well, I can't really build a 7-Eleven in the neighborhood if people are afraid to go shopping there after 8:30 at night. And you talk to people who are trying to improve schools, and they say, well, it makes it harder to recruit teachers and to get parents to be willing to send their kids to that school if that neighborhood is dangerous. And these problems are all very interconnected. It is certainly something when I talk to people in Chicago, young people who are in our studies or all of the people that we come across in our work, almost everyone that we see has some sort of very personal experience with the violence. And there's a lot of people walking around in a lot of pain because of they or a loved one has experienced that. And I would include, by the way, people that are themselves perpetrating violence. We did a study of gun offenders in the Cook County Jail, and 40% of the people we interviewed had actually been shot. And, you know, you say, why are you carrying?
I just want you to repeat that. 40%, you said, of people in the Cook County jail system.
Who were gun offenders in our study had actually been shot.
Themselves.
Yes.
Okay.
So you say, why are you carrying a gun? And they say, well, why do you think? And so that the violence problem in some ways becomes self-perpetuating when people feel they have to carry weapons in order to protect themselves from the other guys who are carrying weapons to protect themselves.
Would you suspect that's true then across the state when you look at our criminal justice system? That's not just true of the Cook County system, but that happens not just across the state, but maybe across the country?
I think it is certainly true. A lot of the people who are committing acts of violence are themselves also victims and very worried about becoming victims. And that's why a lot of these young guys arm up and they're walking around with guns because they're afraid of each other. And that's a cycle that can be broken, but it's a challenge to break it.
And then how do you think, I'm curious about, for people who are not living in these communities, but people who are seeing what's happening from different media reports, whether they're conversations like you and I are having, which are maybe a little bit more longer and thoughtful and sort of looking at these sort of more substantial issues, or the daily crime reports, the headlines, the numbers, this person got shot here, this person got shot here. I wonder from your perspective, how you think people who are not involved in the violence but consuming news should be thinking about this.
I'm very concerned about that because it's very easy for people who live far from the violence to have a tremendous sense of psychological distance from the problem, to be sad about it, but to kind of be thinking, well, there's nothing that can really be done about it, and I don't know what's going on with people in these inner cities, but boy, there's a huge amount of violence. And one of the ways that we try to cut through that is to show people, you know, there's some concrete things that we do that help. You know, there's no polio vaccine for the violence, but to show people there are effective interventions that can reduce it. You give young people an opportunity to have a summer job, and they will be significantly less likely to be arrested for a violent offense, for example. And things that we do that are realistic, that show people we can make progress. And I worry quite a bit about the way, and it feeds into the way we talk about, of course, urban communities and race and other issues as well. It's very easy for people to see that through a very negative lens very quickly.
And so are there certain words or phrases that you worry about in particular, or is it just coverage issues that you kind of see and you look at and you kind of wince?
Oh, there's so many things that make me wince. I think terms like the inner city make me wince because they imply where the violence is happening and conjure up a mental image that is often inaccurate. I worry a lot about the way people mix the violence issue with the immigration issue, which is basically unconnected to it. And we're living in a very angry, polarized time. And one of the things that I find very discouraging right now is I think left and right really need to learn from each other about ways to reduce the violence. And we're not having a conversation that is very humane and constructive across the ideological divide right now in criminal justice. And I think that's really important.
I'm speaking with Harold Pollack. He's co-director of the University of Chicago's Crime Lab. He also teaches in the School of Social Service Administration. Harold, as you say that the left and right need to learn from each other, there's certainly, when we think about criminal justice reform, that's actually been an area over the past couple of years where there's been a lot of bipartisan work, where in government, Democrats and Republicans have worked together. You're nodding. I wonder what of those you want to highlight, and then from maybe a more ideological standpoint, what you think more broadly people on the right and left need to learn from each other when we're talking about shootings and communities and shooting deaths.
I do think there's a lot of bipartisan cooperation, and there's a real desire across the political spectrum to reduce mass incarceration. And that goes from the Koch brothers all the way to Senator Sanders. And there's a real desire to deal with nonviolent drug offending differently, for example. I work quite a bit with Chicago police officers who are you know, pretty conservative folks by and large. And a lot of those folks are taking pride in the way that they are thinking differently about low-level drug users and drug sellers that they do not believe are a public safety threat, and that they're trying to put into addiction treatment, things like that. So there's a real hunger across the spectrum to do better, and I think that's a good thing. It comes from different sources. Many of the conservatives that I know have actually spent time volunteering in prisons as, say, chaplains or doing Christian work, and they see a guy there who's 45 who was really dangerous 20 years ago, and they come out and they say, why is this guy here? You know, how this is crazy. We have to do this differently. And so so we do see a lot of a hunger to come together. At the same time, we see tremendous division. You know, if you think on one poll, you know, police unions, at another poll, Black Lives Matter. There's a lot of anger out there for a lot of different reasons. And that sometimes makes it hard for people to reach across those lines. I think that conservatives can learn from liberals about the importance of police legitimacy and the ways that police have to partner with communities and be trusted by communities to be effective. And I think that liberals can learn from conservatives about deterrence sometimes. You know, one of the striking things in our gun work is almost everyone in the city of Chicago and in many other cities who commits a crime with a gun is an illegal possessor of that gun. And, you know, whatever you think of the Second Amendment, you know, a bunch of issues around gun control, gun safety, there's a lot we can do to more effectively clamp down on the illegal gun market that would help us. And liberals and conservatives need to learn from each other and be pragmatic about, you know, what are the strategies that we can try that might be effective when we see a young woman who's buying four or five guns and selling them to people that she knows you know, as a straw purchaser, for example. You know, there's no liberal or conservative response to that. There's really a question, how do we more effectively deter that behavior and use the resources we have in law enforcement and criminal justice system to make that kind of crime less common?
Well, and you certainly hear that in Chicago. You know, we've heard from city officials, from police officials, for I don't know how long, certainly Mayor Emanuel, whoever the police chief has been, whether, you know, just about how many of the guns used in Chicago are either purchased in Indiana or they're brought across. So I imagine as we think about how guns are being crossing state lines, how much that affects Chicago. And Illinois, of course, in general has very strict gun laws compared to neighboring states. So from your academic viewpoint with the crime lab, do you see that as a very practical and fundamental problem that could be solved quickly?
Well, quickly, I don't know. But I do think that, you know, we have a national gun market, and no one city or state, you know, can do it on its own. And it's certainly the case that you can go into Indiana. In fact, you can go outside the city limits of Chicago and face a totally different regulatory environment than you would in the city of Chicago. And the fact that Chicago itself has tough gun laws, you know, doesn't help that much if you can get on your bicycle and go to a gun shop that's outside of that jurisdiction. So we do need to do some pretty sensible things to help ATF do its job better, think about how to strengthen the background check system. There's a number of pragmatic things we can do. I don't think there's any polio vaccine for this, but I think a lot of the people who commit gun crimes, you know, pretty low-level folks who can be hindered in their efforts to get a gun. You have a 21-year-old who's angry at another 21-year-old, and he wants to get his hands on a gun quickly. And if we can make that harder for him to do, first of all, it'll take him longer, and that gives us more time to intervene. And secondly, we can often prevent that. There's a lot of criminal offenders who have trouble getting access to guns, and there's another group of criminal offenders who have easy access to guns. And there's a lot we can accomplish with pretty low-tech stuff to raise the barriers to a lot of people who are going to commit serious gun crimes.
When we're thinking about Chicago, we're thinking about this year, 2016, 2017. There's been a lot of discussion about what police and city officials would do and are trying to do. What do you see as most important for the city of Chicago to be focusing on this year?
Boy, that's a hard one. I think that we really need to be headed on multiple fronts right now. I think one front is police reform and police legitimacy, and that's really important. Communities want police to do their job a little bit differently, and the Justice Department's been involved, and that's one prong of it. I think focusing more aggressively on illegal guns is another prong of it. Providing opportunities like summer jobs and school-based violence prevention is another prong. I don't think there's any one thing that I would put the pedal to the metal on. I think also just improving the operation of police investigations is something that they're working hard on. So there's a number of fronts where people are making steady incremental progress, and I think that's actually where the real progress is going to come. There's not going to be a breakthrough in any one thing. It's going to be just chipping away, rebuilding that police community partnership, focusing more effectively on the guns, doing a better job in prevention, investigation, all those areas.
When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Harold Pollack from the University of Chicago's Crime Lab. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible in part by Krannert Art Museum at the University of Illinois, opening a new season of art exhibitions with an opening night celebration, Thursday, August 31st at 6 p.m. More information is available at kam.illinois.edu.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. I'm speaking with Harold Pollack. He's co-director of the University of Chicago's Crime Lab. We've been talking about Chicago, but all summer long we've been talking about violence and homicide deaths across Illinois and how it doesn't just happen in Chicago. We've been talking about efforts that have been made in Springfield and Peoria and Champaign and Rockford, how different communities across Illinois are working to try to stop the violence. Harold, as you were saying, this is a deep problem. There's a lot of ways that this has to be worked out. You have to sort of chip at a lot of different issues. You've mentioned a lot of really big issues. Yeah. We learned recently on the program about an effort that was launched in both Peoria and Champaign based on the research from David Kennedy, a criminologist in New York, which involves identifying people with a history of gun violence and offering them a fresh start. Here's how former U.S. Attorney Jim Lewis, who was instrumental in getting this program started in Peoria and Champaign, explained it to us.
They haven't gotten all the way in the wrong direction, but they're headed in the wrong direction. Those are the people that you have to talk to. You have to put your arms around them, and you have to say, come on, we do not want you in the criminal justice system. We want to see if you can succeed in our community.
So these Fresh Start programs, that's former U.S. Attorney Jim Lewis. He was very instrumental in these programs, which have started in Peoria and Champaign. Very, I would say, one-on-one programs of mentoring, identifying people very carefully. We had some really interesting conversations with people who had gone through the program. What is this a proven model for reducing gun violence? What do the numbers say? These are really intensive programs working with individuals. How much of a difference does something like that make?
Well, there have been some very promising programs like this. probably the one that people talk about the most is from High Point, North Carolina. One of the striking things about the violence is often two things. One is there's a pretty small number of people who are often at the epicenter of the violence. And very often those people can be reached. Either they can be reached to help them and to say, hey, we're giving you a chance to do something different, or they can be reached to incapacitate them when the person isn't doing something different. And in some ways, if you're in a relatively small city or community, that may even be a little easier to do than in a big place like Chicago, where just the gang scene and so on is just different. And I think things like this are very positive, and they also speak to the hunger in communities to deal with the violence in a more humane way. And I think one of the really important things we need to do to be sustainable is to protect public safety, but to do it in a way that residents of the communities where the violence is the most severe can say, hey, I can feel good about the way we are trying to do this. Because that person who's committing an act of violence, he's not some guy from Mars that we've never heard of who's sort of some evil intruder. He's somebody's nephew. He's somebody's son. He's somebody's husband. And, you know, we're connected to that person through a human connection that matters. And if that person can be salvaged and made a more productive citizen, you know, there's a lot of potential in a lot of these men and women to be productive citizens. And boy, we would rather do that if there's any chance we can do that. And people really respond to that, including, the criminal offenders. I talked to a reasonable number of people who are perpetrating crimes, and they're very concerned about the violence, and many of them want to succeed in the community as much as anyone else.
Harold, you used an interesting term. You said epicenter. Do you think we're at a point now where most people are looking at gun violence and looking at sort of models of public health and disease? And do you think that's kind of a mainstream analogy now of looking at violence like the way a disease would spread, a sort of a public health model?
Oh, I think absolutely. And Gary Slutkin from Ceasefire Cure Violence would be maybe the most prominent local proponent of that, but David Kennedy, others. And if you talk to police chiefs, actually, they will talk about that.
That's what I was going to ask. Is that something that in criminal justice, in police chiefs, from a government perspective, people are also looking at this?
Absolutely. I think many of us think that police officers are very much sort of lock 'em up mentality and so on, and they're not. It turns out that people that are on the front lines of the violence understand that a lot of the behaviors that they are trying to prevent are, you know, arise from the ecosystem that criminal offenders are operating in. And if you could change that ecosystem, these people would behave differently and more constructively. And I hear the public health metaphor from a surprising range of people a lot. And I find that very encouraging.
As I've been saying, we've been having these conversations all summer. And one of the people we spoke with was the police chief in Springfield, Kenny Winslow. Springfield is on track, by the way, to see a threefold increase in the number of people killed or injured by gunfire compared to last year. And when we spoke with Police Chief Kenny Winslow, he explained how the violence is largely concentrated in very specific areas. Let's hear what he had to say.
Yeah, what we're seeing right now is we have two rival groups or gangs that are feuding back and forth, and they've been responsible for about 40% of the shots fires called this year. It's been across the community, but, you know, the vast majority have occurred in our what we call Quad 4, the southeastern portion of the community.
Is that typical then? Is it, as you were saying, that often you're saying it's a small group, a relatively small group of people? Is it also, we think, part of the problem when we're looking at gun violence is it tends to be also confined to a relatively small geographic area, even within cities? Certainly we've seen that. I don't know if you'd say that's true for Chicago in terms of what we've seen, but as across the country?
I think very often that is the setup. And in fact, if you trace out some of the incidents that lead to homicides, it's in some ways it's like something you'd associate with Sicily 100 years ago more than the United States in 2017. There's a particular group of people that are going at it with a particular group of other people. Someone's girlfriend got hurt by somebody else, and then somebody retaliated, and there's a chain of incidents that escalated, and very often it's a pretty small number of people with some pretty concrete beefs with each other you know, that can escalate out of control, and very often the violence, it's difficult to distinguish who initiated what after a while, because there's generally a history. I actually do a lot of work in reasonably dangerous places, and one of the things that always strikes me is I myself am quite safe actually in these environments, because the violence that's occurring is pretty directed. And you know, not that there aren't a lot of tragedies and bystanders who are hurt, but very often the violence, there's a reason why people engage in violence, and there's particular people that they're concerned about.
We also heard from Mayor Langfelder in Springfield talk about how towns like Springfield are investing more in summer activities for at-risk teens. How much is that part of the solution as we think about activities, summer job programs? We always hear that as well. What does the evidence say about that?
I would say 5 years ago, I would have had to say, well, the evidence is pretty sketchy. But there have been a couple of really good randomized trials that have shown that if you take young people and you have a lottery and you offer some kids a summer job and also some help, not just the job, but also some help to keep the job. You know, a 17-year-old kid might need a little mentoring so that he doesn't get fired, you know, the first week when his boss is a little obnoxious to him or whatever. So there's you have to design the job in a way that accounts for that. Sarah Heller's work and some in Chicago and other work in New York City has shown that you know, significantly smaller numbers of young people get arrested. And in fact, in Chicago, what was really surprising was that the benefit actually continued after the summer was over. And so I thought it was very valuable. And the other thing that's great is these young people, they desperately need employment, and they're not taking those jobs to buy Taylor Swift tickets. You know, they're helping their mom out, paying the rent. These are people, these are families that are really hard hit by the economy today, and they need those jobs. And so independent of the effect on crime, it's really dealing with poverty, dealing with the problems that families face all over the state to just put food on the table.
And when you say the benefit lasted throughout the summer, what did the research show on that? What does that mean?
So young people committed fewer violent offenses during the summer, but they actually continued to commit fewer violent offenses after the school year started, and they were done with the job.
So they weren't employed anymore in the summer job program.
So there's something about it, when kids weren't employed in the summer, they would start running with their buddies and getting in trouble, and then that sort of set a behavioral pattern that would continue. And if you gave people a summer job, that seemed to be helpful to kind of reverse that. You know, put a little money in somebody's pocket, give them some structured use of their time, bring them into contact with adults who can be job references for them and so on, and you can have a very positive impact.
I'm speaking with Harold Pollack. He's co-director of the University of Chicago's Crime Lab. We've been having conversations all summer long about violence across communities in Illinois. We were just talking about programs in Peoria and in Springfield and in Champaign. And I wanted to ask you, in the Rockford area, 2016 was one of the worst years for gun violence. Over the past 2 years, the United Way of Rock River Valley has been working with the Rockford Police Department to create strong neighborhood houses based on a model from Racine, Wisconsin. And this gets to another point that we were talking about. So not just jobs, but then there's also sort of this whole issue of community and police and trust. They provide an office for police officers, and there's a library where kids can come in and borrow books. Here's how United Way CEO Paul Logley explained this program.
One police officer that I spoke with said that, you know, he had been working in this neighborhood for years. He said, I'd come to a call, get out of my squad, walk up to the porch, do whatever I had to do, and leave. He said, I never got to know the people. The kids never got to know me. He said, now that I've been in the house for 6 months, I know the kids by name. I get out of the car, and they run over to see me, and they know my name. Now, that's how we start building trust.
That's the Strong Neighborhoods program in Rockford. That was United Way CEO Paul Logley on the 21st earlier this summer. What are your thoughts on how police officers can start to build trust? This isn't necessarily a simple thing like this program, the Strong Neighborhood Houses, but what are your thoughts on ways that this kind of trust can start to be built?
Well, I think that's important for a number of reasons. When I was listening to the story that you just played, one of the things that really struck me is also the human reality of being a police officer. It's very hard to be a police officer right now. And we need to be nurturing those men and women and making sure that they have positive experiences in communities so that they can
and get emotional to know support.
People. Yeah. You know, they bear witness to a huge amount of trauma, and very often police departments are the safety net for everything else that's screwed up in American public policy. You know, it's not police officers' fault that we don't provide adequate access to addiction treatment, that we have bad gun policies, that we don't provide enough mental health care, and that we have high levels of unemployment and so on. But when all of those failures lead someone to commit a criminal act, we expect police officers to go at 3 o'clock in the morning and deal with whatever the human fallout is. And you know, we expect them to be social workers. We expect them to be psychiatrists. We expect them to do a lot of jobs, employment counselors. And I think interventions like the one that you just described give them a chance to have just normal relationships with people. And that's important to build trust with the community and for the community to see police in a different role. But it's also important for the police to just see regular people doing regular things and to just lower the temperature of their involvement. If police are spending all their time responding to 911 calls, it's not very surprising that some of them are going to become very hardened to that community.
I mean, I think it would be a very natural traumatic response for anyone, right?
Absolutely.
As you say that, lower the temperature, we just have a minute or two left, but I can't help but think about the fact that as a country, it sort of seems like the temperature has been rising over the past few years. And particularly in the past 2 years. So I wonder, what are your thoughts on? Are you? I don't know if you would say you're a naturally optimistic person by nature. How do you sort of see us going forward from here?
Well, I am an optimistic person by nature. I do think we're in a difficult national time, and I think President Trump's election was both a cause and a symptom of the trauma that we are experiencing. I think it's very important for people of goodwill from a variety of perspectives to find each other, to cross boundaries, and to make human connections, and also to be evidence-based. Many of the efforts that you're studying will be effective. Some of them will be disappointing. That's the nature of it. We have to keep plugging away, and we have to keep supporting each other, because I think on all sides, people are traumatized. People are angry and they're traumatized, and they want their identities to be respected. If your identity is a police officer, that's true. If your identity is a 17-year-old kid growing up in Springfield, that's true. And we have to find more ways to respect and honor each other and to be hopeful that we can make this problem better. If you compare where we are now to where we were in the early 1990s,
that's what I was just thinking. Historically, we are so much better. We maybe forget that we are doing so much better at this than we were 10, 15 years ago.
That is very true. And I see signs of consensus and humanity that were not there. You know, I started my work in public health during the HIV and the crack epidemics, where the wider society really did not respond in a very compassionate way, either to HIV or to the heroin crack problems that were perceived as inner city problems. And I look now at the opioid epidemic, which is just so tragic all over Illinois and all over the country. And I look at the way that people are getting together and really trying to respond to it effectively. And it has not been one that has been disfigured by the partisanship and the rancor that we've seen in some other domains. I look at the way that incarceration is actually going down. You know, during the Obama years, incarceration actually started to decline, and there was a lot of support among Republicans. I did a lot of work on health reform, and Democrats and Republicans worked very well on the addiction and mental health components of health reform. And so there's a lot that we can take solace in and cooperate with each other in, and we have to look to that. And when we see unworthy aspects of our politics that get the headlines, we have to understand that that's not all there is.
Harold Pollack is the co-director of the University of Chicago's Crime Lab. Harold, I appreciate all of this, your perspective on everything throughout the state as well as nationally and here in Chicago. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you so much for having me.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Thanks for tuning into the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Perhaps you've seen the blue "Hate Has No Home Here" posters and signs that have popped up all across Illinois, in houses of worship, on people's lawns, or in shop windows. Those signs, which have seen renewed interest after the violence in Charlottesville, were actually a result of a small group of neighbors who came together in Chicago's North Park area. Now they're getting requests for the signs, magnets, and window posters, not just from towns across central Illinois, but from as far away as Ecuador and Sweden. The group has ditched their Google form and built a website. They've raised more than $15,000. That original sign had five languages. Now it's available in nearly three dozen and spawned more than 130 individual campaigns in communities across the world. Two of the campaign's many organizers, Carmen Rodriguez and Megan Trinter, are in studio with me now in Chicago. Megan, Carmen, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you so much for having
us. Thank you for having us.
So North Park, that's on the northwest side of Chicago. Who wants to tell me a little bit more about your neighborhood? Carmen? Oh, Carmen's looking at Megan. Go ahead,
no,
Megan.
Go ahead, Carmen.
I will take that one. So North Park is a kind of a pocketed community. It's closed in by some interesting barriers in that we have a campus at the west end, a couple of cemeteries thrown in there, and then a 64-acre nature preserve. So unless you know it's there, you don't know it's there. And it's made up of a very diverse community of people, ages, economics, cultures, languages. So it's got a unique composition.
And why is diversity and having your neighbors be proud of that so important to you guys in the neighborhood, Megan?
Well, I can say that I have four kids and they all go to the neighborhood school, and the neighborhood school is really representative of the diversity of the neighborhood in general. And so for me, I am in that neighborhood and we are participants in the things that go on in that neighborhood on purpose. And so I want to celebrate it. I want to acknowledge it. I want to acknowledge what that brings to my life and how that is great for me raising kids there and being a part of that community.
And Carmen, how did this "Hate Has No Home Here" campaign first get started? This isn't the first kind of things you guys have done as a neighborhood.
It isn't. And honestly, the current nature of the project is entirely accidental. Awesome, but accidental. Our community had multiple times come together to celebrate itself and to reassure itself after difficult things had happened. So after the Orlando shootings, we had gotten together and done kind of a similar, clearly much smaller scale project where we'd put up posters in our neighborhood that just said, "All are welcome, North Park neighbors." At a different point, we had put little ribbons on our stoops, and those were just ribbons for peace, kind of reminding everyone that our neighborhood welcomes everyone, accepts everyone, and is a peaceful place. We ended up putting ribbons all around the school. So in the fall of 2016, one of our neighbors, I think rather innocently, asked in the neighborhood Facebook group, "Hey, are we going to do anything to kind of address some of the hate speech and rhetoric that had been on the rise in the world, really, but a little bit in our neighborhood, too?" And that's really where this all kind of came together. We just thought we'd do another project, a little poster project.
So it came from a Facebook group. And did it come in response to a particular incident or just sort of general thoughts and feelings people had?
I mean, I think it's no secret that there was just a rise in tension last year. There was just a lot of...
You're talking about after the election?
No.
Before the election?
Before the election. Our conversation started well before the election. And we got it kind of together in the fall, but even before the election. So it wasn't necessarily election specific or politics specific. It was just in the air.
We posted pictures of what your logo looks like online on Twitter and Facebook. But Megan, can you describe for listeners what the "Hate Has No Home Here" logo and the posters look like?
Absolutely. The "Hate Has No Home Here" is our slogan. And many of the posters, although there are a few variations, have the phrase "Hate Has No Home Here" listed in different languages, up to five different languages on the sign. And the logo itself is a heart, and it has the image of an American flag within it.
And where did that come from?
So the artwork was actually designed by one of our neighbors. The slogan came from the children of one of the people working on the project. And then we've had an additional designer working with us on some of the variations on the theme, including additional translations and different flags as the project has migrated outside the United States.
And the slogan, how did that come about? You said there were children in particular that came up with that?
Yeah, so interestingly enough, you know, this was as organic and as kind of loosely put together as a project could be when we were coming up with the idea for what our poster would be, kind of as the next wave of what are we doing in the neighborhood to address this. One of the women who was involved with the project from the beginning was talking about it in the car on the way to the zoo with her kids, a third grader and a kindergartner, and the kids were talking about it and came up between the two of them with that "Hate has no home here" message. She texted it to the rest of us who were working on this and said, "Hey, what do you guys think of this? I think it sounds good." And we said, "We think it sounds great. Let's go with that."
How do you guys, I don't know how close you are in terms of neighbors, Megan and Carmen. How would you say that the community is very close in terms of being very organized? Does a lot of this happen via social media? Does it happen in person?
I will argue that there's certainly a level of organization that happens between people that know they want to organize. So the neighborhood Facebook page is very active. And within that, there are some ties between us. We all have kids. We all know each other's values. And we also know that many of the people that started on the group and that are still on the committee are people that will get things done.
And so Get Things Done, you guys started this as like a grassroots, fill out this Google form if you want this poster. And now you all, Carmen, can you give us a sense of the volume of requests you're getting and where they're coming from?
So I think if folks are really interested to see how big this has gotten, we actually have a map on our website, which shows not just places where individual projects are, but just places where posters and signs have been sited. We have the project going in dozens of places in Illinois, way more than that in the United States. We are in Ecuador, Australia, Sweden, Germany. We just had a request for the EU and Canada. So it's definitely bigger than the original 500 posters we were planning on.
You see, you guys are originally planning on 500 posters. Who was going to print that?
We were thinking really big on those 500 posters, actually. so we have an organization in the neighborhood that is affiliated with one of the faith-based groups that has a presence in the neighborhood, and they were able to do the printing for us at cost of the posters. And then ultimately we ended up going to a local printer in the community who actually now is an active member of the group. They were so inspired by it. And they've also done a lot of printing for some of the other satellite groups that have started in the Chicago area.
And then so you now have a website. You've raised more than $15,000 on GoFundMe. What is that money for?
Well, originally, when we started a GoFundMe, one of the original members of the group said, "I'll start a GoFundMe to see if we can get some money to print these signs." And I think we started asking for $600, maybe $800.
Big bucks.
And
like the 500 signs.
Yeah. We were thinking really big there.
And the demand became so high that we raised that. And so every dollar that comes in goes back into printing yard signs and posters and making them available for free to the people that come to us. And I'll just mention that the $15,000 is just with our North Park group. Every other campaign leader that has started in Illinois, there are approximately 15 in the greater Chicagoland area, and then in every other state, raises their own money in whatever way they deem necessary.
And so how many different satellite groups do you guys have now? You're not even keeping track? Yeah. So you guys are...
I'm terrible. You know, each one of us has kind of a role and a responsibility in the group. So one of our other project members is the person responsible for dropping all those pins on our map. And I know that she knows that number really well. At last count, it was 43, but I'm sure it's way bigger
43
than that.
Satellite groups.
Yep.
And why are satellite groups important to you guys? Why aren't you guys just doing it all yourselves?
So this is actually the whole point, because for us, the point was in our neighborhood to make our neighbors feel safe, to make our neighbors feel welcome, so that when somebody was walking down the street, they didn't see someone who looked different from them and think to themselves, oh, this person probably hates me. Instead, they would walk down the street, see the "Hate Has No Home Here" sign, and realize whatever is different about me from this person doesn't hate me. So it was super important to us when we saw this project growing to make sure that other communities had the opportunity to express that in the way that made sense for their community and that caused them to have those conversations themselves. So when we went to our local printer and showed him this sign and said, hey, we need these and can you do this for us, that led to a conversation about how his family came to this country, how afraid his parents were when some of this rhetoric had started building up, and how relieved he was to see our neighborhood sending this message out to one another. We've gotten so many stories like that about different experiences that people are having all over the country and, as it turns out, in other countries, because it's the human connection that is so important.
I would think there are probably very few people who haven't been disturbed by the events in Charlottesville and people who are disheartened. And I wonder for you guys, how has being part of this Hate Has No Home Here campaign changed the way you all view tragedies like what happened in Charlottesville?
I will speak for myself and say that Hate Has No Home Here has become this opportunity for me to literally put a stake in the ground to say how I feel about our country, how I feel about the people within my community, how I feel about the diversity and the people that I live near and with. And so when something like Charlottesville happens, I'm reminded that a sign is a wonderful way to express that to the people around me, but that there's more to do. And I certainly am reminded how important it is for everybody when we have, after Charlottesville, people emailing us, Facebook messaging us. People want to make that message clear to their communities as well.
Carmen?
Yeah, I would say to that, that it's unfortunate that we have to be so useful, but I'm grateful that we're so useful to so many people. This last week, I was actually driving across the country to drop my daughter off at school. So it was kind of an interesting experience to be traveling across the country at the same time that my phone was just blowing up with phone calls with people asking how they could get involved, how they could participate, how they could share this message, because it's the ugliness is not the only thing that's out there. And I think that was so important for us when we started this, and it continues to be important for people not to just hear ugly messages and hatred. It's really important for people to hear that a lot of people believe in goodness, in kindness, in respect, and in civil discourse. And that's what this project does. It gives everybody a chance to feel like they're not alone when they are rejecting hate.
That said, people who are listening, how can they get a sign of their own? How can they get involved if they want to?
So first things first, we'd like them to go to the website. It's www.hatehasnohomehere.org. The artwork is downloadable for free. We do have some usage guidelines on there and ask everyone to please respect those usage guidelines. There's also information there on how to either print for yourself, take to a local printer, or if you're so inspired, start your own project in your neighborhood, in your community, and in whatever way you're able to, we encourage people to share that message. Just want to make sure we give credit to everybody who participated. This was definitely and continues to be a group effort. There's no one person in charge or anything like that. And that has been really super cool, that it's all been kind of like this equal measure of people giving their talents.
That's Carmen Rodriguez and Megan Trinter, both of them two neighbors who are volunteers as part of the Hate Has No Home Here campaign, which started in the Chicago neighborhood of North Park and, as they've been telling us, has spread all over the world. Carmen, Megan, thanks for being with me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
That does it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. And if you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Tell her, ask NPR One to play The 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, every other way to contact us. If you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us on social media, is again at our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Christine Herman, Alan Montecilio, and Bob Holly. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo, broadcasting today from Northwestern University's Medill Graduate School of Journalism in downtown Chicago. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.